Smyrna is telling us what real religion must do. Real religion must provide an answer to death. There are unanswered questions to suffering, of course. But if the religion that you have this morning does not provide you, if it does not provide you an answer to death, then I ask you, what good is it?
Welcome to the God-Centered Life with Josh Moody. We're taking a look at the book of Revelation, specifically the seven letters to the churches, in a series called What Jesus Thinks About Religion. Today, the letter to Smyrna comes zooming into focus. Josh Moody is senior pastor of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois. My name's Todd Westy. Thanks for joining us. Josh, it's got to be a bit of an unnerving experience for the church at Smyrna. They open a letter and the phrase, "Do not fear what you are about to suffer," comes rolling out. And yet there's a number of today takeaways for us from this passage, right?
Yeah. I mean, I suspect they knew that something bad was coming because of the political scene at the time and their Christian faith running counter to that.
Good point. Yeah.
And so Jesus is saying, don't be frightened about that. And of course, there's much great relevance there. I would say one of the key tones of contemporary Christianity, certainly in the West, is fear. People are frightened about what the secular society is going to do. They're frightened what the state's going to do. They're frightened about COVID. And so this message, don't fear about what's going to happen, is of great relevance to us, I think.
Chapter 2 of the book of Revelation, we're looking specifically at verses 8 through 11. Here's Josh.
Let's stand together as we come to the Bible. Revelation chapter 2, we're looking at the second letter to the church, this time in Smyrna. Revelation chapter 2, beginning at verse 8. "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death." Do please sit down, my friends. It was Sigmund Freud who popularized the notion that societies have certain taboos. In his book, Totem and Taboo, Freud argued that in the same way that primitive societies have literal totems and taboos, contemporary societies have the same, though in less physical and more subtle ways. These totems, that is a sort of religious centrifugal force for a society that garners attention and around which we gather, and such taboos, that is a sort of unmentionable a grouping of fears, things that you do not talk about, a taboo. Together, he argued, they sort of forge a twin power that shapes culture and even influences the interactions of individuals within that culture, whether they know it or not. I suppose, rather more simply, sometimes in the past, the advice was given that if you want to get along in society, there are certain things you do not talk about in public. You know, it used to be said, don't talk about religion and politics or sex, perhaps, for that matter, in public. Taboos, then, he would have said, are facets. They're parts of a sort of social structure which exert a kind of psychological power. And the taboos are things that people are afraid to have to confront, cannot even mention, though they're there. Sort of elephant in the room, I guess. Mythical 1950s America and the Victorian 19th century were supposed to have never ever broached one particular topic, that is sex, of course. But nowadays, in our society today, talking about sex is perhaps a little awkward in church, but it happens so much on TV or in magazines like Vogue or the equivalent blogs that it's almost boring. It certainly isn't a taboo topic. And religion, well, that's very much back on the public agenda. And politics, you can hardly turn on the radio without hearing some talk radio going on about whatever they feel about politics. No, we're an open society these days. We let it all hang out and we talk about everything. But is there nothing which exerts the hidden power of a taboo even today in our society? Yes, I think there is. And it's a matter which is right at the heart of the passage we're studying. That subject is the subject of death. Astonishingly enough, death is rarely mentioned today. It's not as if it's an uncommon experience, after all. But something about the materialistic ideals of our society mean that the topic of death is at least near taboo-like. After all, if we somehow think that he who has the most toys at the end of his life wins, we don't want to be reminded that the same person will still die, however many toys he has. Now, you will die, as will I, and we need to talk about it, face up to it, confront it. Well, this passage this morning is designed to help us do just that. See, what it's telling us is that true Christianity is faithful even to the point of death. You see, Smyrna, which along with Philadelphia, shares the commendation of being the only church that received unmixed praise from the Lord Jesus in these seven letters to the seven churches of Asia. Smyrna is telling us what real religion must do. Real religion must provide an answer to death. It must. Now, we often talk about the mystery of suffering and maybe death, and there are unanswered questions to suffering, of course. But if the religion that you have this morning does not provide you with an answer to the greatest taboo of them all today, if it does not provide you an answer to death, then I ask you, what good is it? It certainly isn't real Christianity. I mean, the Bible is unashamed to tell us that if only for this life we have hope, then we are to be more pitied than all men. But this faith, this true Christianity that we espouse together here at College Church, it must be a faith that is faithful, as it puts it here, unto death. Or else it's meaningless, practically useless, pointless. Well, Smyrna shows us the way forward. You see, Smyrna, like Ephesus, was a successful and large city. And Smyrna was just situated 30 miles north of Ephesus. And actually, it's the only one of the seven cities which received these seven letters that is still in existence today. Modern-day Izmir is the second largest city in Asiatic Turkey. Ancient Smyrna probably numbered about 200,000 people or so. And it was famous for a number of things. It was famous for being a beautiful city. Its architecture was considered second to none. And it had a beautiful road which sort of wound up Mount Pagus from the harbor, reaching fully 500 feet above sea level, like a sort of golden necklace around the mountain. It was called the Road of Gold. Its coinage reflected a certain pride in its beauty. The coins of Smyrna read, "Smyrna, first in Asia, great and beautiful." And actually, it claimed to be the birthplace of Homer, the author of epic poetry. But Smyrna was also notorious for its suffering. After having been once founded, it was raised to the level of a gathering of villages for about 300 years until it was refounded about a century or so before Christ's birth, and it had suffered terribly. In fact, the very word Smyrna, by which it was known, popularly, maybe not accurately, but popularly, was thought to represent this myth of suffering for the city. It derived, you see, from the word myrrh, which was the spice used to embalm and therefore associated with death and suffering. Beauty, suffering. And also Smyrna was known for its loyalty. You see, it was among the first cities that sided with Rome before its emergence as the world superpower. It was the first to build a temple to Dea Roma, and it joined with Rome before its victory over the Carthaginian Empire. And so it was known as a notably loyal and faithful city to Rome. It won over 11 other cities in Asia the privilege of building a temple to Tiberius. Beautiful, suffering, faithful. Yeah, as we'll see, each of these relevant themes for the city of Smyrna is skillfully picked out and addressed in the letter that it received. See, these letters, remember, as we began to see last week in the letter to Ephesus, are historical letters, historical documents written to real churches that really existed in Asia. And here we see Smyrna commended and exhorted that true Christianity is faithful even unto death. So it says, isn't it, verse 10, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life."
Josh is going to unpack this letter in just a second, but first a quick reminder that GodCenteredLife.org has resources that we've put together for you, ways to connect with us, opportunities for you to partner with us, and other resources that we hope would help you in your pursuit of a God-centered life. Back into our study in the book of Revelation, though, in the meantime, here's Josh.
Well, the letter to Smyrna describes this true Christianity in three ways. First, it says that Jesus rose from the dead. Second, it says that we who follow Jesus will rise from the dead. Third, it says, in the meantime, even though afflicted, we are rich. Well, last week we saw that religion without love is not Christianity. And that's what Jesus thinks about religion as he wrote to the church at Ephesus. This week we see that true Christianity is faithful even unto death, even to the point of death. Well, how's that? Well, first then, because Jesus rose from the dead. Look at verse 8. "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life." And see, this is telling us that true Christianity has an answer to death and is able to be faithful even to the point of death because Jesus rose from the dead. He is the first and the last. That is, Jesus is the sovereign Lord of time and eternity, who always was and is and will be. There's no more comforting doctrine for those suffering than the sovereignty of God. But for those facing death, well, not only is Jesus sovereign, he has also conquered death itself. He is the first and last who died and came to life. And it's this resurrection of Jesus that gives those of us who are Christians power over death itself and the fear of death. Now, of course, that idea is taught in many other places in the New Testament, the second half of our Bibles. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, describes at length how, because Jesus rose from the dead, we can be sure that we too will rise from the dead who believe in him. You see, the trouble with death is you don't know what it's like until you get there, and then it's too late. But for the Christian, Jesus has gone there first. He has conquered. And therefore, he shows us the way to the Father. Now, each of these letters actually picks out an aspect of the introductory description of Jesus in chapter 1 of the book of Revelation. And here, the phrase, first and last, and died and came to life, well, that had a special meaning to Smyrna, which was no doubt why that particular identification of the speaker, the Lord Jesus, was chosen. Smyrna was a city that had been destroyed and yet lived. It had been sacked, razed to the ground, and yet now was once more a bustling metropolis. And so the verse may indicate this kind of reference for them at the time more precisely than we might notice if we don't think about it carefully. Jesus is the one who died and lived. The city was a city that had died and lived. So they who put their faith in Jesus would live too because Jesus rose from the dead. Well, if anyone tells you that Christianity then can survive without a belief in the real historical resurrection of Jesus from the dead, don't believe them. The fact that Jesus rose from the dead is essential to Orthodox Christianity, to true Christianity. This is how we can know that, second, we who follow Jesus will rise from the dead. So look at verse 11. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. So conquering, that is remaining full of faith in Jesus, even at death, results in eternal life. That's what that verse is saying. You see, the second death is a Hebrew term. Rabbis used it to describe the death of the wicked in the next life. And so the book of Revelation describes this second death in Revelation 20, verse 14, as the lake of fire. And in Revelation 21, verse 8, this second death is described as the final lot of the cowardly, the faithless, and the detestable. But he who conquers by faith will escape what we more normally call this hell. Even if they are put to death for their faith here, they will not suffer the second death, the far more serious condemnation of fire and judgment that God will bring on the unfaithful. No, we who follow Jesus will rise from the dead. Now, will you notice that there is no view of purgatory here? There is no intermediate waiting room of semi-torture? No, if we are faithful, we will rise to new life. Of course, many other views of death are propounded, some humorous, many sad. I don't know what it says about me, but I have a rather lengthy collection of deathbed anecdotes of the great and famous. Some less famous too. Some of them are funny and well known. You may have heard that on his 75th birthday, Churchill was asked whether he was ready to meet his maker, and in typical Churchillian bombastic form replied, "I'm ready to meet my maker, but whether my maker is ready for the ordeal of meeting me is another matter," you know. Some are poignant, even though they are funny, like Woody Allen, who's well known for many quips, some helpful, some less so. But he said, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying," which is very funny, but also very poignant. And the movie that perhaps best encapsulated the sadness of death was a movie that I heard one pastor said was his favorite movie before he watched it again, the movie Blade Runner, you know. It's a cult sci-fi movie. And Blade Runner depicted a humanoid fighting for his life and ironically concerned to prolong a manufactured existence, you see. And sort of trying to plumb the depths of the meaning of being human. Towards the end of this movie, the sort of superhuman android begins to wax lyrical about all he has seen and done in his short life. He stands on top of a building and slowly, inevitably dying as the rain pours down his face and he says, "All these moments shall be lost like tears in rain." Death is a great sadness. It is a loss. But for the Christian, it need not end there. If we are faithful, we remain faithful to Jesus up until death. If. The perseverance of the saints, as the old doctrine was called. That's what the phrase unto death means. It does not mean stopping at death, but including death, faithful unto death. If we remain such as we die, we will receive the crown of life. Of life, it's a genitive grammatically, the genitive there meaning the crown that consists in life. The crown which is life will rise to new life. Well, then, what do you believe? Are you willing this morning to face up to the taboo of our materialistic culture? Are you willing to face death and ask the unmentionable question, what will happen when I die? Am I sure of my eternal salvation? Am I sure that I have the crown of life and not the lake of fire? Remember, there's no in-between. Self-righteous works will only secure us the lake of fire. It is faith that we need.
That's Josh Moody, and this is The God-Centered Life. So this letter to Smyrna describing true Christianity in three ways. The first two, confirming Jesus rose from the dead. And then secondly, we who follow Jesus will also rise from the dead. And that is a huge statement in today's world. So just over the last year or so, Josh, many saw a very real prospect of dying moving much closer than in our non-COVID world. So without getting all cause and effect, can we perhaps suggest that God has used the pandemic to further the spiritual journey of individuals?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question comes back to your basic theological grid, to what extent you think God is sovereign over everything. I believe the Bible teaches very clearly that God is sovereignly in control of absolutely everything. So of course he uses a pandemic. He's in charge of the tsunami, and he's in charge of the sunset. And that doesn't mean that we always understand what he's doing with these various natural disasters and calamities. But how much worse to think that he's not in charge? Because unless we believe he is in charge, we can't believe that he's up to something good. And we know by faith he is. And we know ultimately, because of the cross, that that's a place of great evil, and yet God is sovereignly in charge of even the cross to bring about good. And of course, that's a key. God weaves together even evil things for the good of those who love him. So yes, we can answer that, but it comes down to a cross-centered view of God's sovereignty.
I think it's interesting as well. We're talking about Smyrna. We'll move on to Pergamum very shortly. Cities that were facing either imminent or current really heavy persecution. So, you know, those that say the world is much worse today than it is, this has been a constant. The world has fallen, it's broken, and that's...
Right. Yeah. There's a great gap of historical knowledge. If we could get a slightly bigger perspective, we could see that God has been in charge throughout history and is in charge indeed today.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you for that, Josh. Grace, Max Lucado. That's the book that's currently on offer. GodCenteredLife.org. A donation of any amount. We'd be happy to send you this powerful book. GodCenteredLife.org. Next time we get together, we're talking about the rich beggar.
The poverty here mentioned is actually of an extreme kind. This word for poverty in Greek means destitution. It means having to beg. Nonetheless, Jesus says, you're still rich.
continuing our study in the book of Revelation. When we get together next time, GodCenteredLife.org, resources for you, and this is your warm invitation to join us for the next edition of the God-Centered Life with Josh Moody.